Province Projects and Operations Subcommittee to order. This evening, Director Leahy has an excused absence. Jim Thompson will be filling in for that position. A copy of the Open Meeting Act is posted at the rear of the room. If you have questions about that, you can go refer to that. Forum call, please.
Conley?
Here.
Deeser?
Who?
Cluth?
Here.
Thompson?
Here.
And
here. Cool. Adoption of the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Roll call, please.
Mr. Conley and Mr. Cluth.
Yeah, you're good. That's true.
Sounds good.
It won't make any difference.
Deeser?
Yes.
Cluth?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Brett Conley?
Aye.
Yes, I have here affidavit of proof of publication of tonight's meeting, and that'll be part of the permanent records. Before we go into the major agenda items, Marlon Peterman is going to take just a minute and explain why John Winkler isn't with us tonight. Go ahead, Marlon.
Yeah, the John is out of town at APWA conference in Kearney, and he's actually their keynote speaker tonight at that conference.
APA, what is it?
APWA, American Public Works Association. American Public Works Association. He also will glad to be there because one of our employees, Zach Nelson, is receiving from the APWA Young Professional Year Award at that conference, so he's not here tonight. And then Martin Cleveland's been a longtime member of APWA. So they're all attorney, and so I'm here.
Well, it will depend on you then. Okay. Now, going ahead with item six is a presentation on the draft Lower Platte Conservation Consortium Drought Contingency Plan. Paul Woodward and John Engel, please.
Good evening. I just get the pleasure tonight of introducing John Engel, who most of you are familiar with HDR Engineering, and he's going to go over the bulk of the presentation. Backward.
Alrighty.
And laser.
Laser. Yeah.
All right, thank you. Here tonight, we're wrapping up a couple-year effort on this plan and thought it would be a good opportunity to present some of the draft findings to you and the contents of the plan. And talk a little bit about the path forward and wrapping this up. For a little background, the consortium, it consists of the Lower Platte South NRD, the Lower Platte North, the Papio, the City of Lincoln, particularly the Lincoln Water System, Metropolitan Utilities District, and the Department of Natural Resources. And it was really focused on studying long-term water supplies available to the Lower Platte River for enhancing stream flows, or aquifer storage to support sustainable public water systems. That's directly from the charter of the interlocal agreement of the group. For some background, you probably remember about, I guess it was about a year ago, we wrapped up a Lower Platte Basin planning effort. And that included the three NRDs from the consortium, as well as the NRDs from the Loop and the Elkhorn River basins. And a large part of that effort was looking at supplies and uses within the basin. And what we found was that, by and large, there's plenty of water in the Lower Platte. There is times where there's some shortages in late July and August. And the philosophy of that group was called the Coalition, not to be confused with the Consortium. And the philosophy of the Coalition was we aren't going to sacrifice development of new uses for those few weeks every few years when there is a shortage. They weren't going to forego opportunities to develop new municipal and industrial uses, add irrigated acres, things like that, that would drive economic development in the region. So really the consortium's effort builds upon that and is focused on those few weeks every few years. So that's really the purpose of our planning effort. This study, on behalf of the consortium, we were able to secure funding from the Bureau of Reclamation Water Smart Grant program, as well as the water sustainability funding source from the state. About 80%, almost 80% of this effort was funded through those two grant contributions. An intro into the drought contingency planning process, really it consists, and I'm going to talk about primarily the monitoring, the vulnerability assessment, the mitigation and response actions, and then the administrative framework tonight. The vulnerability assessment, that was conducted by engaging water users throughout the Lower Platte. We had an open house this past spring to identify who's vulnerable to a drought and make sure that they were incorporated into the plan. Generally, there's all sorts of potential vulnerabilities, but to summarize, certainly the agricultural sector is vulnerable in a drought condition. The public water supplies, MUD, City of Lincoln, Fremont, all of those that rely upon flows in the Platte River to recharge their alluvial well fields. And then certainly there's a recreation vulnerability during low flows and environmental, the fish kills, things like that that occur in the Lower Platte during times of shortage. So those were the vulnerable sectors that were identified. A little bit on the drought monitoring. We looked at a variety of different indicators that could predict drought and could be monitored and set with triggers for response and mitigation actions. We've settled on a couple of them. There are a lot of other factors I'll touch on in a minute, but those associated with the triggers are the Palmer Drought Severity Index, which is published by NOAA every couple of weeks. We looked at it and looked at the drought of 2012, the drought period 2002 to 2005, and had a very good correlation. And then the other indicator is actually the actual stream flow in the Platte River. And really below about 1,500 CFS, particularly the City of Lincoln, their well field capacity starts to decline, and about 500 CFS is a real critical threshold where their capacity has a real steep decline. So we associated triggers with those in the monitoring. And this is just, I pulled this off last week, this is the current Palmer Drought Severity Index, as you would expect based on the last month or two. The majority of the Platte River Basin is in the extremely moist. Our particular area is in the very moist. But they update this every 2 weeks, and it's a live document that's continually updated. For stream flow, one of the things that we did for a forecasting element is looked at a recession curve and developed a tool using some USGS methodology where you can look at starting May 15th, you could put in the flow at Ashland, and it would give you a forecast in the absence of rainfall what the flows would be to help forecast those triggers. You have thresholds, and it tells you 10, 30, 60 days out what you can expect for flows, and it just adds to your responsiveness. We calibrated it versus 2012, and that's what's shown here. From June to July in 2012, this is the Platte River at Duncan, and I'll talk a little bit more about the importance of the Upper Platte. But this is the flow in the Loup River, flow in the Elkhorn River, and flow at the black line is the flow at Ashland, and then this red line is what the recession curve prediction is. So it becomes a useful tool when you start looking at, in theory, if you're doing a monitoring, you can project out this time frame. You have a trigger that you do, or a critical threshold that you have a mitigation action. You can get the timing correct and have that be more proactive in your management and response during a drought. This is kind of the monitoring protocol that we've developed, and just to walk you through it, generally about this time of year, we would be starting in this portion of the monitoring, and at that point, we're really looking at how we came through the last peak demand season. What are the aquifer levels? We have an idea of how hard people pumped. We were monitoring the Palmer Index year-round. As you get in later in the year, the NRDs are collecting their static water levels. You get an idea of the aquifer health, how hard they pump the aquifer. In December, we would start monitoring snowpack. And that snowpack is, you know, generally the plain snowpack in the Loop and the Elkhorn and the Lower Platte contributes very little to flows in July. But, you know, certainly in the Lower Platte, when the drought conditions are the worst is when the Upper Platte becomes disconnected from the Lower Platte above Duncan. And, you know, like in 2012, it got dry almost to Grand Island. And the snowpack in the Rockies, particularly on the South Platte, where there's not Lake McConaughey or Pathfinder, or there's storage, it's largely unregulated. A good snowpack in the South Platte can sustain flows through into July in the Lower Platte. So it's an indicator to keep an eye on is there the potential for the Upper Platte to become disconnected. And typically the snowpack readings in March and April are really where you get your true reading of what it's going to look like. Also in the spring, you got an idea of your static groundwater levels from the NRDs. The Lincoln Water System also tracks their what they call their remaining operating volume of their aquifer that usually reaches in the upper 90% over the winter season. So you get a lot of information at this time heading into the peak demand season, and then in early May we start looking at river flows and using the forecasting tool again to monitor river flows in the Lower Platte. Drought management, there's two types of things. Mitigation actions are those things that are put in ahead of time to mitigate or reduce the potential risks and impacts of a drought. And then response actions are those things that you actually do during a drought to lessen the impacts. I'm going to talk primarily tonight about the mitigation actions. And we cast a wide net on what are some of the potential mitigation actions that could be used to augment flows. Again, we're targeting that 2 or 3 week period in July or August to bolster stream flows. We looked at six different types that I'm going to talk about tonight. One was importing water from the Missouri River. We looked at surface water storage options. That's using both existing facilities as well as a couple new reservoirs. We looked at canal recharge. We looked at alluvial aquifer pumping. That's pumping water from the alluvial aquifer directly to the river. And then groundwater augmentation pumping. And the difference between those two, which I'll get into, is just the location of where you're pumping from. And they have a little bit different function because of that. And then the last thing we looked at is similar to what the Republican Basin has in their compact compliance plan is a rapid response area where you would curtail irrigation during the peak season and it would increase stream flows. So I'll talk in a little more detail on each of these. If there's any questions during these, I by all means interrupt me. It's probably easier to do it as we go rather than to come back. So the first option we looked at was importing Missouri River water. And this alternative looked at essentially an alluvial well field. This is Blair right here. Arlington's over here in the lower left. It would involve a well field in the alluvial aquifer of the Missouri, north of Blair. It would have a main that would parallel the right-of-way of Highway 91 and then discharge into a tributary of Bell Creek. We were targeting, for all these alternatives, we were targeting about 100 CFS of augmentation flow. And so this would require about 32 wells. It's got an 11-mile force main and would discharge into that. We used wells instead of a surface water diversion for a couple reasons. One, the surface water diversion is very, you know, the complexity and the oscillating levels on the Missouri River, the potential for ice, and probably the most important thing is with all the threatened and endangered species, the biological opinion, all the things that the Missouri River entails currently and certainly probably in the future, we thought it would be cleaner just out of the alluvial well field.
You said to interrupt. I'm going to interrupt with a question,
yes.
John. How does this sighting of this tentative water main coincide with the next step for MUD when their next step is to go to the Missouri River farther up north?
You know, MUD was part of the consortium, and they didn't talk about that as being a conflict. I'm not certain.
Didn't come up.
It didn't come up.
Okay. That's good. Thank you.
So I'll get into some of the storage options then. This first one is looking at Sherman Reservoir. It's in the Loup River Basin on the Middle Loup. It was attractive because it's owned by the Loup Reclamation District. They bought themselves back from the Bureau, I think in 2001, which makes it attractive from a standpoint of they would be able to negotiate and utilize some of that storage. If the Bureau still owned it, it would literally take an act of Congress to get it approved. So we looked at it as a potential source. The Middle Loup is fed by base flows. The reservoir fills every single year. And in this alternative, we looked at purchasing about 11,000 acre-feet of storage water. And the concept on this would be that they would have that water available to call upon for release to augment flows in times of shortage. For reference, 11,000 acre-feet at normal pool is about 3 feet on Sherman. I think they have about 35 feet to operate. 11,000 acre-feet is about 3 feet. The top 3 feet is what you'd be purchasing. We assume their agreement would limit the frequency just for the viability of their surface water irrigators. I think for costing purposes, we assume that we'd be able to call upon that water twice a decade. The thing about the Loup River and the conveyance, getting the water from here to Ashland, you lose about two-thirds of the water just in conveyance losses. It shows up eventually, but the attenuation that occurs is pretty substantial. Now, it's not lost completely. It goes into bank storage. It eventually shows up, improves the resilience of the system overall. But as far as trying to hit a target peak flow augmentation at Ashland, about two-thirds of it is lost.
You're basically going to get out of the 3 foot.
Yeah, I've got some summary table that shows kind of what actually shows up during that period. This is one of the new storage reservoirs, and it's a new structure. It's not a new site. This was studied by the Corps of Engineers in Lower Platte North in the late 60s and again in the early 80s. But it's a new storage reservoir on Skull Creek for orientation. That's Abbey right here. The village of Linwood is about right here. It's about 3 miles off the Platte River. This alternative had a normal pool storage of about a little over 12,000 acre-feet. It would capture runoff from the watershed, but it could only do that. This would be junior to all appropriations on the Platte River, so in-stream flow, irrigation, induced recharge, all those senior uses would be able. They wouldn't be able to store water during that period. But the concept is it would store water when it could. It would be available to release upon demand. It's about a three-day travel time, I believe, from the release here to Ashland. Much closer to the point of to the gauge at Ashland. About 80% of the releases would reach Ashland, is our estimate.
Is this facility already built, this reservoir?
No, it's a new.
You say new, it needs to be built.
Yeah, if Sherman exists and is there, this structure would be a new project. It would need to be constructed. Likewise, Bell Creek Reservoir was another site. This is another site that would be a new structure. It doesn't exist. It was studied about 4 or 5 years ago, I think, by the Lower Elkhorn NRD. As an augmentation or a recharge site. You can see here the reddish area is the boundaries of this district. The green is the Lower Elkhorn. To orientate it, Herman's right over here. Winslow's right over here. This structure would have a normal storage of a little over 13,000 acre-feet. It's got a drainage area of about 130 square miles. Again, it would capture runoff in times of excess. It would be subject to administration for senior appropriators. It would be available to release water during that critical period. And it also, we're estimating about 80% of the water released would reach the Ashland gauge. One of the things we looked at on Bell Creek was also pairing it with the Missouri River import. The previous alternative looking at the Missouri River was down here along Highway 91. There's also a similar location up near Takema. I think it's Highway 52. 51. Yeah, there's a similar roadway right away, similar distance that could be used in conjunction with the reservoir. The advantage being you could greatly reduce the size of the well field and the force main and fill this up over an extended period. The primary advantage to this would be the reliability of the water supply. In times of a 2-3-4 year drought, there is the potential that there wouldn't be adequate runoff or base flow to fill the reservoir, and it wouldn't be available every year. You would have an independent source to fill the reservoir and be able to retime those flows for release.
Because on the reservoirs without pumping and filling them in, what was the estimate as far as you might get water once every 5 or so?
We assumed, that's a good question. Both of these, Skull Creek and Bell Creek, we sized the pools are at about 1.5% or 2% of the drainage area, which in eastern Nebraska is kind of on the lower threshold. And so we're so we assume that they would be available every year for delivery of that water.
John, does that mean that you would pump and fill it every year?
As necessary, you could.
Is that the concept that you'd have it full
every
before you know
year.
Whether you're going into a drought or not?
Yep. Okay. Yep. You would pump it primarily during the off season and fill it. This alternative was looking at, again, this is looking at up in the Loop Basin. Sherman Reservoir is right in here. There are some existing surface water irrigation canal districts that are out there. In this concept, you would divert water during the shoulder seasons outside of the peak season, early spring, fall, when demands are less and there's excess flows available. You would use those canals as essentially linear recharge features. It would passively recharge the aquifer, and the subsequent base flow returns would also be passive. You'd have increased base flow returns throughout the year. Key thing about this one is, you know, it doesn't have an active. You can't, when you're in July and August, there's not a button to push to call upon the water. It accretes all year round, so it's not a targeted as some of the other active management options. Again, we're talking about a third of the accretions in the peak flow during that period reach Ashland due to the conveyance losses. The alluvial aquifer, and in this case we use the sand pits the sand pits, that is essentially the alluvial aquifer levels adjacent to the plat. And so rather than sink a deep well field, what we did was use the concept where you would essentially put a suction bell or some sort of intake into the sand pits to deliver the water. You can see the number of sand pits, as you are well aware, in the Platte River Valley. We looked at this area down here by Lake Clagus. There's 3 or 4 sand pits in the vicinity there that could be in. I think there's a couple of them that are interconnected currently. They could all be interconnected. What we were trying to do was look at about 1,000 acres of surface area, because in order to meet that 100 CFS for about a 15-day period, you need about 3,000 or 4,000 acre feet. So we thought if we could get about 1,000 acre feet of surface area, we could work out an agreement to get 3 feet of that to get an adequate volume. So that's what this concept is. It would have a suction bells, a short stick of pipe, pump water directly to the river. Again, we assumed that the agreement with the owners would limit the frequency it would be available. I think we assumed maybe 1 in 4 years we'd be able to call upon that water. One of the things, and it's kind of highlighted the difference between the other well field we're going to talk about, is it's pretty closely connected to the Platte River. And so it limits its use. If drought conditions are coming on in early July, because of that close connection, if you use this alternative, the depletions would be felt very quickly, and you could actually be making conditions worse in August. And so this would be a more of a August 1st or later alternative to augment flows. And this one is more of like the Endcorp concept. What we did is we laid this green line that's on here is kind of the 90-day stream depletion line. As I said, you know, the alluvial aquifer is probably on the order of 10 to 20 to 30 days before those depletive effects start to be felt. This would be at least anything outside of this green line would be at least 90 days before those depletive effects, so you wouldn't have the chance of making things worse during the drought condition during low flows. This would be a well field. We looked at a couple alternatives. You know, conceptually, there's the Todd Valley that's over here that is a good water-bearing formation that could have a pipeline for discharge to the Platte. Another area would be this area in between the Elkhorn and the Platte, east of Fremont. I was just at the Lower Platte North board meeting last week, and they had three or four producers that were in complaining about high groundwater table in this area right here that may make it suitable, solve a couple different issues. But that in this concept, would again, you would, upon shortages or triggers, you would turn on the well field and discharge water either in this location from the Platte or the Elkhorn. And then the final option is kind of that rapid response dry year lease. And what we did is we looked at the area that was fairly well hydrologically connected. This shape that's drawn along the main channel has a 5-foot buffer on each side. Essentially, it's a 10-foot band. Bandwidth along the Lower Platte River below Columbus. Each one of these green dots is a high capacity irrigation well. It's about 310,000 irrigated acres that fall within that 10 mile boundary. And the concept on this would be essentially like a retainer. You would have an agreement with the landowners. You would pay them a retainer. In the instance that you called upon that dry year lease, there would be an escalator. We looked at it based on the differential between irrigated and dry land rental rates to base our costs on. Again, on this one, we assumed that there would be a limitation on the frequency of calling on the dry year lease just for the viability of the producer. I think we used two and twice per decade for this alternative as well. So this is kind of a summary, a table of the nuts and bolts of the yield, the cost, and then kind of a metric. And it takes a little bit to explain. What we did is because some of them aren't available every year, we looked at a hypothetical 20-year period. And so what you'll see here as we go across is each of the alternatives, and they're kind of color-coded. This is the import. These four are the storage. This green one's the combination of the Bell Creek and the import from Missouri River. These are the canal recharge, and then these are all those individual ones. This is the 20-year cumulative volume that would show up, or that would the project would yield, and that's at the source. And so, in this second column is over the 20 years, what would actually show up at Ashland. So, for instance, the import in the Missouri River water, that comes in similar to where Bell Creek is. You're losing about 20% by the time it gets to Ashland. These up in the Loop Basin, that's your two-thirds loss that shows up. Just for reference, this 59,400 acre feet, that's every year, 15 days, 100 CFS. So those are, when you see that number of cumulative volume, those were all able to meet and provide that 100 CFS, at least at the source, every single year. This is the costs, and it's for those, and we tried to kind of normalize them because some of them are agreements Some of them are capital costs. We didn't take into account the time value of money over the 20 years. But the import of the Missouri River water, that's essentially capital costs for the well field, the force main, the land, and includes an operating cost for it. The Sherman release, and I didn't talk about the cost for that, but that again is a kind of a retainer with an escalator that would be when you called upon the water. We use the same basis. The 11,000 acre feet serves about 10,000 acres, so you'd be paying about $150 an acre for 10,000 acres in those years that you called upon the water. So that's what's included in there. The Skull Creek and Bell Creek, those are the capital costs of constructing those sites for the land, the facility. The Middle Loop, this includes the lease rate. And the way that typically those have been set up in the Upper Platte is with those districts, it's a flat annual fee, like a retainer or a right to use their facilities. And then a per acre foot that they actually recharge, they get paid. And so it's a similar structure to estimate those. And the rest are pretty self-explanatory as far as what the yield is. And as you can see, they're no small costs. They're all pretty hefty price tags. But one of the things that we've been talking about is the effect of what the drought in 2012, the city of Lincoln thought about putting a call on the river, and they've got a priority right in 1964, and there's over 50,000 acres, probably close to 100,000 acres that would be subject to an administrative call that would have to give up their right to irrigate. And when you start talking about the economic impacts of a region of 100,000 acres, it's 50 to 100 million for a single administrative call. And that's tangible. And when you start thinking about economic development in the Platte Corridor, the Omaha-Lincoln area, for large data farms and things like that. I know Lincoln, in our meetings, they're very sensitive to the public perception, and they're still stinging from 2012 some of the perception about the vulnerability of their water supply, and they still think they're paying from it from an economic development standpoint. A few notes, and I think I've hit most of these. You know, the canal recharge and dry year lease, they're passive. You aren't able to target a specific time of year, but they certainly have benefit throughout the year and improve the overall resiliency. I think I've described some of the assumptions that went into these agreements. Certainly those would be independent negotiations that will ultimately dictate the costs. And one thing I wanted to highlight, when you start thinking about drought resiliency, the access to the Missouri River is really the only alternative that imports from an external source. And because of the vast amount of storage in the Missouri River system, because it operates for navigation purposes, It's relatively drought resistant to anything, that certainly compared to all the other alternatives which are within the Platte Basin, extended 2-5-7 year drought in the Platte, some of these measures may not be available for that full duration. As I said, the consortium itself has no projects in place at this time. And so really the main response actions that are available are the coordination on a couple things. The coordination of management activities being undertaken by each of the individual entities, and coordination of communication amongst the members and communication with the public overall. And with NEMA, the Missouri River Basin Group has a drought monitoring. And so those are the primary response actions. There are individual response actions that each of the elements have that aren't part of the plan. Those will continue to be maintained. Certainly, MUD, Lincoln Water, they have rate structures and water allocations that they implement based on demand and shortages. As I said, the Department of Natural Resources has the Surface Water Administration, where they can place a call on the river
you know, the one of the main focuses of this contingency plan was that as a last resort. It has a lot of political and economic ramifications to place an administrative call on the river. And both Lincoln Water System and MUD have appropriations that could be called. The NRDs have their groundwater management and allocation areas that they do to manage based on aquifer levels. MUD and Lincoln Water System in 2012, it's not a formal agreement, but informally, what they did when the flows started to drop off, MUD switched a larger portion of their supply to the Missouri River to relieve some of the burden on the Platte River that benefited Lincoln Water during late July and August. And then finally, and it occurred right after we started this effort, they started kicking the tires in earnest, but Lincoln Water and MUD, and they're just starting this now, and they're starting to look at an interconnection, which would provide Lincoln a redundant source in the Missouri River. And it's at its infancy. It's they're just now evaluating the technical feasibility, and then once they get past that, then there's political and financial and all of those other legal things that will need to be wrangled, but they are at least looking at the technical feasibility of an interconnection of the two systems. The administrative framework, you know, and simple, what does the plan do? It establishes a monitoring and communication protocols for consistency of information, and it provides coordination of water management activities. I referenced the Bureau Water Smart grant that funded part of this effort. It offers that program has a chunk of money, I think $3 to $5 million a year that's set aside for planning efforts. There's a sister program that sets aside $35 to $50 million a year, I believe, for implementation. So just by completing this plan, we're eligible to apply for any mitigation actions that the group decides to pursue, should they, and it provides the opportunity to further investigate these mitigation actions that have been identified, conceptually what they would look like, some of the challenges, the pros, the cons, and some of the uncertainties associated with them. And so going forward, the consortium has a means to further evaluate those, prioritize, seek out funding partners, things like that. What the plan doesn't do, it doesn't supersede any of the individual member programs, the allocations that the NRDs manage, the rates and the allocations that the water purveyors provide to their users. It doesn't dictate any individual actions. It doesn't infringe on any of the entities' local control. As I said, we're wrapping it up. The next steps, we've got a draft of the document that we're getting comments from each of the consortium members. We have a public open house scheduled December 5th. That's a Wednesday from 5 to 7 at Lower Platte South NRD. Much of the same information you saw tonight will be presented there. Our schedule calls for a final draft to be submitted to the Bureau of Reclamation on February 1st. They've got a 30-day review period in which we'll get comments and incorporate as needed. And then we'll bring it back to the individual members for approval of the plan next spring.
Thank you, John. Any directors have questions?
I have one. What exactly would you be approving then? Is this general overview plan, or are you going to pick one of these, or what?
No, not at that time. The plan would be for the monitoring, the communication protocols, the action items, continued participation in the consortium.
There's nothing going forward that you're actually pursuing one of those options.
Not at this time, no. No.
I think one of the ideas is the plan just goes through all those options because, like most of the other plans we discussed, it wouldn't make them available for funding in the future or make them eligible for other funding like the Bureau of Reclamation has other funding. And then Marlon kind of compared it to like what we do every year for ice jams. This would be setting up something we're always going to kind of be involved with. So even this year when we've had great wet year and we shouldn't be concerned about drought, we're at least going to go through steps of meeting and talking about it where, you know, that'll be a good thing when a drought actually does come around and we've kind of got a process that you do every year.
You have to have something in place before the drought.
And that's what this will set up, is a just a process that you go through every year to work together.
John, I've got a question for the basis of this study. How does it take into account the flexibility that both MUD and Lincoln have to ban lawn sprinkling during drought conditions? Would they take the position if they implement this, they would just go ahead and implement this and let lawn sprinkling go on?
No, this wouldn't. Those are the kind of individual entity controls and administrative actions that they would take that wouldn't be part of the consortium. They would certainly communicate that, but I don't think their intent is to relax any of their current drought mitigation measures.
Okay, but this would be needed above and beyond the benefits they would get from alternate day sprinkling or something like that.
Correct.
Other questions, sir? Director Teaser.
John, I was asked yesterday, on the clay disk, how are the weights being interconnected? How do you physically...
Through like equalization tubes, there was four or five of them in that area that had, there's a very short distance between them.
Right, okay, I'm running 264 feet. Okay.
Right.
Okay, but so we're running just pipes between the...
Yeah, yep.
Okay, so one of my constituents right away said, how do I keep my fish from going into his lake?
Put a fish fence, huh? Yeah, that we didn't include cost for fish barriers or anything like that.
But that, I mean, this honestly got concerned.
Yeah. Yeah, if someone's got carp and they don't want to...
Yeah, they got their walleye.
Yeah.
Any other... yes, John.
Yeah, I got a question. Like over a year's period, I saw the numbers up there. Like say if you have a drought year or just even an average year, what do you spend to buy water rights? What would you spend to buy the water rights? Or you're talking about buying water, paying landowners for water. How many millions is that?
Yeah. It varies. What we used as a means to for what it would cost, like I'll use the Sherman one as an example. What we said is, well, in their net irrigation requirements typically a foot, 12 inches of water.
Mm-hmm.
And so they would need an acre foot of water
mm-hmm.
to irrigate an acre of ground. And so if we were going to take 10,000 acre feet of water, it would essentially be purchasing the irrigation rights from 10,000 acres of land. And what we used as a basis was the difference between what an irrigated rental rate, per acre irrigated rental rate versus dry land irrigated.
Mm-hmm.
Per,
mm-hmm.
And it kind of varies. I think up there we used about we either used 150 or 200 bucks as the difference. So if I pay 80 bucks an acre for dry land crop, I'd pay 280 up there for irrigated. And so in that given year, you'd have $200 per acre for 10,000 acres. That would be the check you would write for the right to call on that water.
Okay, because my other question would be, what if you were to pull the water off the Missouri River, what's the charge for that?
It would be the cost of the
capital. Just the pipeline?
Yeah, the pumps, the pipeline.
In the
you would
long
have to
run,
pay for the water. You'd have to pay for all the infrastructure to get it.
In the long run, if you set up an infrastructure of a pipeline coming across and let people come off of it to store the water, I mean, in the long run, wouldn't that be cheaper?
It very well could, yeah.
Because if the water's free, you pay for the pipeline once, you're done.
Yeah.
The water's free, but it's a pipe that costs.
Yeah.
Even if you need the water's free.
You carry a lot of buckets.
Yeah.
I'm just curious. I just thought, you know.
Yeah, those are considerations.
You should run a pipeline across, let Lincoln tap into it, let Grand Island, Beatrice, all the bigger communities that threaten your aquifer, you know, when it gets low and, you know, everybody's pulling water off of it at the same time. If you have a consistent flow of water, wouldn't that help this situation?
Yeah, would. This is much smaller in scale. This would be only like 10 or 11 miles,
right,
so it
right.
wouldn't extend to those. But, yeah, I mean, in the concept.
My guess is in the long run, is it a cheaper cost?
Yeah.
In the next 10, 20 years, just like your study was 20 years, I mean, would you spend half as much money to run the pipeline?
Right. And as you said, it's a fairly drought tolerant source.
Right.
Because of the supply.
Yes.
Another question, if I could, John. At the NERD conference, they were talking about some talk about Lincoln putting a direct line to the Missouri. What have you heard about that? Or
yeah, they had looked at that. We had actually done their last water master plan update. I think it was 2014. And that was one of the options they looked at, was an alluvial well field that would pump water from the Missouri directly to their treatment plant. And it was on the order of those costs. The one thing, the reason we were discharging it to the river was it met some of those other requirements, the fish, it met the recreation, those other vulnerable sectors is why we had put it in the river rather than directly pumping it there.
Did I see another hand on this?
Follow off on Rich's question. They submitted a project for water sustainability funds for that well field. It didn't get approved, but assuming that's a good alternative for Lincoln, that's downstream of where the water is needed, upstream. So really, it may or may not, I don't think it'll affect other than lessen the demand from, I guess, upstream sources.
Right. That would be, it would serve a singular purpose in meeting their water demands. It wouldn't benefit MUD and their well field.
So as a consortium, I mean, if that's a whole other project and many millions of dollars.
Right.
But what John's saying, if you put that up north, then conceivably they could have a benefit from that.
Right.
Based on the further continuance of MUD and Lincoln Water.
Yep.
So as a whole for Nebraska, it might be better to look at top and down. Huh?
Right. The longer the reach of impact is always better.
Yeah. All right.
I've got a top secret question I want you to divulge. When are you going to move into your new office?
I think they started moving last week.
Good.
I think my move date is December 7th.
Wrap it up by the end of the year?
I think I'm the last one to, well, not me, but my floor is the last to move. So.
Great. Well, that's good news. Director Marlon, go ahead.
I just, again, we wanted to bring this to you and brief you. You'll see this again, as you saw on the schedule for action in February, but see, start thinking about these things. We've got that open house with Lincoln 5th. And any questions you have, any thoughts, please share them. Again, we'll be voting on this, just adopting this plan. Probably in March somewhere.
Thank you. Thank you, John, for being
Thank
here.
You.
Now, moving ahead on to item 7 is review and recommendation to amend District Policy 16.7, District Property Donation Recognition, and District Policy 9.3, PPO Subcommittee Jurisdiction. Marlon Peterman.
Well, this is, you have a memorandum in front of you. This is a direct result of a request from the board to look at the developing a naming policy for reservoirs, recreation areas, or other district properties. And so John took a look at our current policies and feels that is recommending that we have a policy now, 16.7, that covers naming facilities. If an individual makes a donation toward that facility, financial donation. And so just adding to that and is what's proposed in the red line document that you have that shows a policy and a procedure for naming the site. It also would involve, so that would be amending policy 16.7 that now is just donation recognition and expanding it to donation recognition and naming of NRD reservoirs, recreation areas, and a property. The second item is it is assigning jurisdiction, I guess, to the PPO subcommittee. So amending policy 9.3 that would list it as one of the responsibilities of project of this committee to head up that meeting.
I move the staff recommendation.
Okay. Hey, anyone in the public wish to speak to this? Seeing none, directors. Director Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank City Papillion for establishing some of the framework of that. As you know, last month we had some discussion about dam sites 6 and 7, and we got a copy of their naming policy, and this was extracted from their policy, so I want to give them credit for what they did. A couple of things to note that at the bottom of the first page about general practice not to consider politicians naming the policy in the naming policy. That's certainly unique to us. Probably a takeoff from other politicians that had lakes named after them and streets named after them and so on. So I just want to highlight too the historical naming, geographic naming, individuals, those who had significant role, current or past accomplishments. Those three things. And obviously, as our role as a public entity, to name these things for the future. So I think it's good policy since we want to name the next six dam sites, and we have to name dam site 6 coming up. As to our local interlocal agreement, Papillion. But since we didn't have a naming policy, it's important to get this one on the books.
Thank you, Director Thompson. Any other comments? Seeing none, roll call on the motion, please.
Booth?
Yes.
Thompson?
Yes.
Rick Conley? Beezer?
Yes.
Yes. I believe that concludes our agenda, doesn't
it? I might just note that when it comes to the board agenda, it will be to lay that motion over for a month because, according to your policies, this is one of the policy areas that has to be laid over for a month for consideration and then voted on following.
Thank you for that.
We'll call the FEL subcommittee to order. Larry Bradley is absent tonight, so I'm going to ask Fred Conley to fill in with that. Notification of Open Meeting Act in the back door and outside on the wall. And moving forward, item 3, quorum call.
Fred Conley?
Here. Here.
Here.
Here.
Yeah. Here. Thank you. Adoption agenda.
So moved.
Second.
Roll call.
Booth?
Yes.
Yes.
Reese?
Yes.
Aye.
Yes. Item 6, review and recommendation of participation in the Nebraska Public Agency Investment Trust, Kerry Fry and Candy Sanders, NPAIT. And what does NAIPT stand for? Yes.
Nebraska Public Agency Investment Trust.
It's the same thing John Winker told me. yesterday.
Good evening. For the last several years, interest rates have been historically low, and the best cash management strategy for the district was to save funds and checking to be able to bring credit to the cost of nominal. But now that rates are going up again and earnings credit increased, we've been looking for alternatives to provide a better return on taxpayer money. But our options under statute for loan policy are very limited. Luckily, the Nebraska Public Agency Investment Trust was specifically created to meet Nebraska public costs. So, here to talk a little bit about it.
Thank you. It's I'm going to refer to it as NPATE because Nebraska Public Agency Investment Trust is pretty long and I get parsed. I'd like to start with the history of NPATE. It was started in 1995 when public officials realized that individuals were getting a better interest rate, anywhere between 5.5% to 6%, and public entities were getting 2.5%, maybe 3%. But right now, everyone would like to be back in that great environment. these individuals got others involved, and that would be the Nebraska Association of County Officials, the Nebraska Rural Electric Association, Miles Capital out of Des Moines, Iowa, and Union Bank and Trust out of Lincoln. They worked very hard to get the Nebraska legislature to finally pass an interlocal agreement which allowed public entities to legally pool funds. From there, NPATE was created, and we accepted our first deposits on July 1st, 1996 of $14 million. Currently, in our daily trust, we have over $260 million, and at times, depending on the time of the year, we've gone over $425 million. So what is NPATE? NPATE is a trust account. So the first thing that means is it is not covered by FDIC insurance. However, every dollar that goes into the trust, we are buying some type of government-backed security, and only those types of securities that are legal under the laws of Nebraska. We do not have a minimum balance requirement, nor do we cap our participants. They can put any dollar amount that they want to put in. We also do not limit our customers to a certain amount of transactions per month. This may sound very similar to a money market account, but the differences are, is the money market account up to $250,000, you do have FDIC insurance. After that, the financial institution is required to give you pledging. They have a minimum balance requirement and often limit you to 3 to 5 withdrawals per month. So how does NPATE operate? We have a board of trustees, and currently there are 13 board members, and they represent different public entities throughout the state of Nebraska. They in turn hired service providers. Again, those are Union Bank and Trust, Investors Management Group out of Des Moines, Iowa. They are the portfolio manager. And the reason why they were selected and part of the whole process originally is they've managed a similar program called IPATE. So we're not even original with our name. Then Union Bank and Trust, they act as the administrator, the custodian, and the marketing. In other words, when you call in to do a transfer, it is somebody that's sitting it at Union Bank that's answering that phone, doing the transfer, and mailing out statements, and then obviously I'm the marketing person. They have their own compliance officer, and they hire their own auditors to do an audit. We also have 9 state associations that endorse NPATE. That means they tell their members that it's a good program. They've looked at it, and it's, you know, a good alternative or an addition to your current checking account. And the Nebraska Association of Resource Districts is a sponsor. Jim Benfeld of the Central Platte NRD currently sits on the MPATE board. I'm going to stress that we have expenses of the trust. We don't charge fees to our customers. The first is the Board of Trustees can take up to 10 basis points, and that is to pay for the compliance officer, the audit, or anything relating to the board. The service providers have their individual expenses, and then the sponsoring associations can also take up to 10 basis points, and they can use those fees to offset, some of them offset your membership fees, some use it for administrative fees. That's up to the sponsor what they use those funds for. What this means is if you called me today and asked me what the rate was, I would have said 1.72. That means the securities in the portfolio are worth 2.342. So you will never, as a participant, you would never see a fee charge on your statement because it's already included in an interlocal agreement through the expenses of the trust. One thing that I really like about MPATE, I kind of promoted it when I started doing the marketing, is sub-accounting. And what that is participants given an individual six-digit number followed by 001, and they may use that for operating or general expenses. Then you can open up sub-account 002 for maybe tree funds, 003, a specific project. Those funds are kept separate. They earn the same rate no matter what the balance. We don't limit you to how many sub-accounts you can open. And the really nice thing is we don't make you do additional paperwork unless you have different local banking information tied to it, and then it's just one form. And again, they get their own statement. So it's like separate accounts, but it's all under one enabling resolution. Besides the daily, we have what we call fixed-term investments, very similar to the traditional bank CD. This is the only time we do ask for a minimum, and it's $100,000. Currently, we are using the CDRS program. That's where we're finding the best rates. We've also used repurchase agreements in the past, or we've bought bonds for individual participants. Our current terms are 6, 12, and 24 months, and I forgot to update those. They should read 2%, 2.3, and 2.5% right now. Sorry about that. So how do you become a participant? You need to pass the enabling resolution. After that, we require two other forms, a W-9 and the banking information. And what that does is allow you to stay in your office, make a toll-free call to us, and we can initiate an ACH to or from your local bank account. Question?
How do you make your money?
The expenses of the trust.
Okay, what are the expenses of the trust? And what is the rate? Because whoever puts money in this, they're going to get a fee somewhere.
They don't technically get a fee, like I said, because we're taking it off the securities before that rate's quoted to you. So I think it's roughly 57 basis points is divided amongst all.
Give me a percentage. I don't know what a point is. I mean, are you going to charge 1%, 2%, 1.5%?
It's 0.57%, right?
Yeah, 0.57%.
Okay, 0.57%. Is that for every?
Roughly,
okay, what does that cover? For
what that covers is.
Is that per 100,000?
That's.
Or per transaction?
Off the top of the security. Just no matter. So every day, depending on what the balance is, if it's 20 million, we're taking 57 basis points off of that 20 million. If it drops down to 100,000, then we're only taking the 57 basis points off that $100,000. So it doesn't change.
What do you charge per transaction?
We don't charge.
So if I called you 10 times in a week,
you can zero. Zero.
But you're going to charge 0.57 off of whatever I have in there.
It's not you individually. It's all the funds in the trust.
Commissioner Conley?
The points that you have for the various categories that you listed there, that adds up to the 0.57% then?
Not quite sure. I don't think I have the adding correct, but that's what my goal was, yes.
Okay, that's the number now.
Yeah, that's the maximum.
How often is that, when is that collected? Is it annually? Is it prorated and collected monthly? How do you assess that fee against the money that's in there?
It's accrued daily. Just like the interest is accrued daily for the participant.
So there's a daily charge against your fund calculated here.
It's accruing. And then they pay out at the end of the month.
Okay.
The sponsors, the service providers, the participants.
Thank you.
Commissioner Thompson.
Here, we've got cash on hand. The intent is to put this cash in their hands, and we collect interest on it.
Yeah.
Pardon? Yep. So how often will we need to have a transaction? Is it just when we get low at the beginning, when we can't get our tax funds receipts in right away? We use a cash balance. So they're holding the money. We're accruing interest on it, and then we'll take it whenever we call it, I guess. Is that the word? And then pay our bills and what have you. So will there be a one-time transaction with these folks, or will it be, we'll keep it in there until we need it? And we're not talking $20 million. We're talking, what, $50,000 maybe?
Well.
$100,000 at the most?
Currently, we're sitting on quite a large amount of cash. We accumulate funds, for example, the Missouri River Levy project until that.
Okay.
$2 million sitting on hand that we could make some more off this way. Sub-account, if you're speaking about that, would be one we could set up. And part of the beauty of this liquidity that we can withdraw the money as max on in the meantime, set up CDs. And with the sometimes unpredictable timing of construction draws, land acquisition.
Currently, we'll buy a CD maybe for 6 months, whereas these folks, we can give that money to them, earn a higher rate than a CD, and have more liquid. Cool.
One thing to consider with CDs, too, is that we're required to keep our balances at any given bank below the FDIC limit. So the amount that we would like to invest, we would spread pretty thinly.
Huh. So we play a little game now then with that.
We already have real water CDs all over the place.
So this would make it easier.
It would be more convenient for everyone.
Nice.
Carrie, would you clarify the amount of interest we're getting for our funds that we're holding now?
Well, a little convoluted. Our earnings credit at Wells Fargo that we received to offset these 0.5, and the interest we receive above that is 0.18. However, any earnings credits that we accrue in a month over the amount necessary to offset fees does not carry forward and they don't out. So effectively, we'd be making more than a full percent addition.
That's real money.
That's the dollar amount we're looking at.
Thank you.
Can I hear a motion? Professor Leisha?
You were talking about it was insured up to $250,000. Is that what you're saying?
That's a money market account. NPAIT does not have FDIC insurance, but
it has none?
None. No, because it is a trust account.
What happens if
something crazy happens and we have $20 million in there.
We are purchasing government-backed securities. Every dollar that goes into
it. Will we get our $20 million back? How long does it take?
If everything went haywire like we've got more to worry about.
A problem, is what I'm saying.
It's as fast as the government's going to reimburse.
I don't want to have to write a check.
But the same thing could happen on the bank side. If you have over the $250,000, they're pledging their securities back to you. So it's the same concept. Mm-hmm. It's however long it would take the government to reimburse.
Okay. Because I know a trust does not work by the same rules as an FDIC does. So I personally am a little leery of the trust. I've seen some that have went kind of crazy. And so... Are you rated by like financial groups and like bonds, different things you do are rated by AAA, AA, B, C, D? Are you rated?
No.
Is your trust rated anywhere?
No, we're not rated. And that was a choice from the board when it was originally set up because there are additional costs for that. And since it was only going to be for Nebraska public agencies, mm-hmm. they didn't feel that they wanted to invest those funds in there, rather pay the participants the extra money. They hire their own auditors, and currently they are using Pete Marwick, KPGM.
Okay. So we're guaranteed.
Yes.
I move approval of the staff recommendation, please.
I'll second.
Yes. Thank you. If we do go down this path, is it introducing any additional risk that we're dealing above what we're dealing with today? And if yes, what are those risks?
I don't. The deposit is collateralized to the same way they are. We're already.
I noted you said Jim Benfeld from Central Flat was on your committee. Top-notch man. I have a lot of faith in him. He's been a very good man.
I have one more question then. So all these various CDs and all these other accounts we've got scattered all over in all these banks, we would eliminate all those and bring it into this one central location?
Depending on how rates go, we
right, so they can do that. So I guess who makes that decision as to whether or not that's going to be done if we go along with it?
That'd be made by John and Kerry.
Any further discussion?
Question, what kind of government-backed securities are you guys going for?
We buy T-bills, bonds, notes, anything that is legal under the laws of Nebraska. And I believe that Kerry supplied you with our information statement, and others are listed on that page one.
Okay. I'll do that. I failed to ask. Any comments from the general public? Okay. Any further? Here, roll call.
Yes.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Item 7, review the recommendation of Artisan Buyout Purchase Agreement. Lori, good evening.
So we have before you tonight the last purchase of our Arlington Buyout project. Bill, can you go to the map, please? So this project was funded through FEMA's Flood Mitigation Assistance Program with the Village of Arlington and the district splitting the local share and FEMA covering the federal share of this project. Last month, if you remember, we purchased a house right here. The board approved the purchase agreement there. The house next door also flooded. So we have that before you. The property was appraised at $72,000, and the owner has accepted that appraised value. Again, FEMA funding covers this. This particular property is classified as severe repetitive loss, which means that it's either had four separate claims in $5,000 or more, or two claims where the total was more than the value of the house. So this is definitely an issue for this owner, and FEMA is covering 100% of the cost of this structure. There is no local match. They cover the cost of the purchase, closing costs, and demolition costs. With that, I can answer any questions.
So, like the other property, it will then be turned over to the City of Arlington, that the
yes.
blank land?
Yes, our agreement with the Village of Arlington states that we will turn over ownership of these two lots so that they would have to maintain them in perpetuity. But they would be deed restricted. We have to file a deed restriction. That's part of our grant requirements to ensure that nothing is ever built on these properties again, other than things like, you know, maybe a picnic shelter or something like that, kind of public use.
Is it our expense, though, to demolish the property?
That will be covered with the grant.
That is also covered. Mm-hmm. Was that the same on the other houses?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so on the other house, we have to pay a 10% local match on that house.
Mm-hmm.
And that'll be covered. We'll pay 5%. The village will pay 5%. FEMA pays 90%. This one is 100% FEMA.
Let's get a motion, guys.
Thank you. Please. I move a staff recommendation.
Second.
Thank you. Anybody from the general public wish to comment? Staff, directions? Seeing none, roll call.
Please.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. Thank you. Item 8, review and recommendation of land acquisition at Grasskey Crossing. Amanda, good evening.
Good evening. This one's a long time coming.
One of my favorite subjects.
Yeah. We had a public hearing in April for this property. And if you could go to the map, maybe we'll just... This is 3 acres. We requested this property from the Grasskey family. It's right adjacent to our current Grasskey landing here, river access for the Elkhorn River. So we are looking at these 3 acres directly adjacent to the property that we have now in order to expand parking just because of the popularity of the river access points and everyone doing all the tanking and tubing. So we had a public hearing. We had an appraisal done. We presented that to the landowners, and you were presented with their counteroffer, which we reviewed and thought that was fair enough to present to you. The appraisal was $11,000 per acre. They've requested $12,000 because you can see here on the screen what that does to the farmable area there, really between the development going on in Elkhorn and the river. It seems to be a fair point. It is not a very big area, so they might have a little trouble renting it. So in that case, they've offered counter-offered to us that we purchase that for $12,000 per acre, $36,000.
I think one thing the board needs to remember is the original property was last square. They donated to us the actual property for the land.
They did donate that, so, you know, and it is the very property.
And we are in dire need of additional parking. It's just amazing the number of people down there.
I move approval of staff recommendation.
Second.
Anybody from the general public wish to comment? Staff, directors, roll call.
Aye.
Aye. Yes.
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 Yes. Item 9, review recommendation land acquisition from Missouri River R613 through R616 levy improvement. We need to go into executive session, and I'd like to have a motion that we go into exec for discussion on these items.
Second.
Aye.
Was that a motion?
Yeah, I made a motion. Roll call.
Yes.
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 Yes. All right. We need to ask you to please exit at this time. This will be the last.
And it's on the board.
Okay. Motion to go out of exec.
Motion to go out of executive session.
A second?
Second.
Roll call.
Aye.
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 Yes. Yes.
Aye. Yes.
Yes. Okay, we have three recommendations. Darling National LLC, R613 Trash. Well, you got it funny. I'm not going to read it. can we do them all together, or do we need one independent?
We can do them separate.
Okay. Let's do the Darling, the top one. Can I get a motion, please?
I make a motion to approve the Darling National LLC resolution as presented on the board.
Thank you. Second. Any comments from public directors? Roll call.
Yes.
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 Yes. Can I get a motion on the Fairview Golf Company purchase?
I move to accept the Fairview Golf Company Incorporated motion as presented on the board.
Second.
Thank you. Any comments? Directors? Roll call.
Aye.
Yes.
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 Yes. And on the Robbie and Karen Iske, R16 tracks 19 through 21, a motion, please.
Make a motion to accept the Rodney and Karen Iske motion as presented on the board.
The second.
Second.
Thank you, Fred. Comments? Directors? Roll call.
Yes.
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 Aye.
Yes. I believe that completes our agenda and that.
Mr. Chairman, would you please? I just like to make this financial committee aware of the fact that I have yet to receive my reimbursement of expenses after following board policy and procedures, and my request of you, sirs, to add it to Thursday night's meeting.
You're out of order. Actually, it's not an agenda item, so.
Made my request, sir. Point of order.
We are adjourned.